Good morning, North Boulevard. Those of you who are here present at the East Campus, or those of you online, I'm so glad you're here. Had a great Sunday last Sunday. I don't know if you know this, we have 140 small groups at North Boulevard. And most of you went out with your small groups, prayed all over Rutherford County, and a lot of cool stories have come back, and a lot of us just were really moved by the experience. But I do want to say, even if you weren't moved, if it wasn't like a particularly emotional experience, remind yourself that God answers prayers whether we feel it or not. In fact, praying is just the right thing to do. So there'll be blessings that'll come maybe even years down the road that we can't see just yet. Okay, I've been asked four different times this week what's going on with my health, and I feel like I haven't given you an update. So let me give you an itsy-bitsy update. I got good news and I won't say bad news, but not as good news. The good news is that the immunotherapy I'm taking has eliminated a lot of my tumors, and all of them have shrunk. We're really excited about that. But immunotherapy trains your immune system to attack the cancer. I'm a rare case where my immune system has gone overboard and it's attacked some of my own organs. So I've had to put the immunotherapy on hold. That's why they're giving me the steroids, because they kind of help with this autoimmune issue that I've developed. And then we'll reevaluate, and they'll decide whether to resume it, maybe change the formula. The indications are that it's even working without me taking those treatments. Now, here's how that applies to you. First of all, my immune system has affected a number of organs, but I think that my adrenal gland has shut down, and that makes me a little bit more susceptible to catching a disease. That's why I'm doing elbows and not hugging and kissing. In fact, if I hug you and kiss you this morning, you'll know Julie's not in the room. The other thing is that since my adrenaline gland, I've only got one left now, has essentially shut down, it's a really weird feeling. So exhaustion is one of the side effects of that. I haven't felt exhausted as much as I feel like my mind is not quite fully in my body. I don't even know how to explain it, but I may stare at you for a few seconds when you talk to me, and it's not that I don't remember your name, which might be true too, but it's that I'm trying to figure out, am I actually in this room right now? It's just a really weird feeling, and I just think it goes really well with preaching. We'll see. It's like smoking crack and preaching. Not that I know how that is. But if I ever knew how it was, I'm sure it would be similar. See, there's a perfect example right there of what it does to you. It makes you say things that you have no idea why you just said them. But if you have ever smoked crack and preached, talk to me afterwards, because I'd like to know how it went. Oh, me. Friends don't let friends with adrenal failure preach. There you go. Okay, let's go back 20 years or so, and we're in a Russian orphanage with two young boys, not quite 2 years old. I'm told by their adopted father that they had never seen the sunlight. They'd never played in grass. They'd never been in a car. They'd never heard a car door shut. They never traveled down a road at 60 miles per hour. They had never eaten solid food until the year 2002, when Russell and Maria Moore adopted them. Now, Russell Moore is currently the managing editor. He's over the Christianity Today. For a long time, he worked with the ERLC, a big wing of the Southern Baptist Convention. They went over and they adopted these two boys and brought them home. And here's a picture of the family. The two oldest are the two boys they adopted. And they had problems getting pregnant, and when she finally did get pregnant, she had a couple of miscarriages, and it was just a really emotional experience for them to do this. It took, as you would expect, a lot of money and a lot of time for them to pull this off. As they were driving away from the orphanage, Moore says in his book, Adopted for Life, that the two children were in the back of the seat screaming and reaching back for the orphanage, that they were terrified to leave. They'd never been in a car. They had no idea who these people were. And he said, all I could think of the whole time was, you have no idea what's awaiting you. Parents who love you, grandparents who will dote on you, a life that's filled with all the things that you're not going to get here. And he said, even when he brought them home, for a long time, they were terrified, and it was a huge adjustment. This is the paragraph that sort of strikes me when I read through the book. He said, quote, "We knew that the boys had acclimated to our home, that they trusted us, when they stopped hiding food in their high chairs. They knew that there would be another meal coming, and they wouldn't have to fight for the scraps, that this would be their new normal." So I've often thought, what is it that makes parents, in this case, Russell and Maria Moore, travel 5,000 miles, give up a huge chunk of their lives, pay literally tens of thousands of dollars to adopt these two boys? And the answer you already know. We crave family. We were designed for family. God created us to grow up in families. In fact, when God wants to describe our relationship to God, he uses the model of adoption. In this text, which is almost a summary text of God's part of our salvation, the Lord says that in Christ, he chose us even before he created the heavens and the earth so that he might adopt us to become his children. It is the case that we were created for families. And that's why for many of us, stories about families, those heartwarming stories, they're like the most emotional stories you can ever get. As we approach the holiday season, you know, all the movies will come out about families and how families survived this or that crisis, and usually they end up in tears, and we watch them over and over and over again because we just want to feel that thing all over again. And that is because families are really important to who we are. Our birth families are critical to who we are. I just remind you, every single human being was born in a family. A mother and a father came together to produce you, and any human being who walks on this planet had a mother and a father. That God designed us to come forth into a family. With families, we grow up to know all the things that matter in life. We get socialized. We learn whatever skills there are to learn. We learn what it means to love and what it means to live in a relationship. We're literally cared for. A baby simply can't survive without a family. So God designed us this way, and that means families are really, really important to us. And it also means that when there are family problems, they hurt like no other problem. Because families are so intense. They're so intimate. They're so personal. They're so much of who we are that when we have problems in our families, whether it's our birth family, whether it's the family of our extended relatives, whether it's our church family, whenever we have a problem in the family, it just hurts like nothing else. And that just means that it's always a good time for us to pause and look to Scripture and learn from God how to live in a family, how to be everything God wants us to be. I find that out of the Bible gives almost no commands to a family. The Bible gives almost no commands to a family. The reason, of course, is you can't control what anyone else does in your family. Even when you try, you often can't. The thing you can control is what you do. And so in the lesson today, I want you to think about yourself. Man, it's so easy in a lesson like this to think about your husband or your wife and what they're not doing or what you wish were different, or your parents and what you might be angry about, or your children, or someone at church that hasn't treated you right, or they said the wrong thing, or they showed a little arrogance, or whatever. It would be a loss if you work through the book we're about to work through and not pick up on the fact that the Bible commands you to do something in your family. It is the book of Ruth that we want to turn to for the next 7 weeks. So Ruth will take us right up to Christmas. And by the way, Christmas Day is a Sunday this year. So we'll actually get to finish the book of Ruth, which, believe it or not, points to the birth of Jesus on Christmas Sunday. And I want to invite you to bring a Bible. Even when I have the scriptures on the screen behind me, having a Bible right in front of you is like getting an inoculation against error. So I really want you to open up a Bible today to Ruth, the first chapter. We'll just look at the first five verses. Bring a Bible, have it open. If you have it on your phone, open it up. If you don't have one on the phone, there's plenty of free Bibles out there. Download one so that even though the scriptures are behind me, you're able to just sort of do your own thing with the Word of God as we walk through this. And what I want you to see throughout the book of Ruth is that God has a specific way that we are to treat others as family, and that it's actually a wonderfully gracious way. So let's start out with Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So there's actually two things in this verse that are worth noting. The first is we now know the time frame in which Ruth occurred. So Ruth is actually written about a period called the time of the judges. So this is late Bronze Age or early Iron Age in Israel. And what we can say about this is it was probably one of the worst times in Israelite history. I'll put it in the language of judges. This is the period in which Ruth was written, or I should say the period in which Ruth lived. The book was written later. But in Judges 17 and verse 6, we read that there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as they saw fit. So it was a period of anarchy, a period of chaos. In fact, in the second chapter of Judges, so this again is the period in which Ruth lived, we read that there was a great apostasy, a great falling away. Joshua dies. Everyone who lived in Joshua's generation was faithful to God. Another generation came up that wasn't quite as faithful. And the third generation, we read in chapter 2 and verse 11, grew up and they knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. And so they did evil and they followed in the feet of these idols, the Baals, as this translation has it. The second thing you see in chapter 1 and verse 1 of Ruth is that a famine strikes, and you should know the famine that occurred during the period of the judges was not accidental, but it was punishment for their apostasy, for the fact that they were worshiping the Baals. God said, fine, you can have them. By the way, it's not a coincidence that Baal in the Old Testament times was the god of the sky. So when you worshiped him, God said, fine, I'll let him be in charge of your sky. He can be in charge of your rain, and you'll see just what a god he is. And so we read that Deuteronomy 28, if you disobey God, there will be a famine in the land. So here we find Ruth, eventually, in this case, it's Elimelech and Naomi and the two boys, and then they marry, and Ruth is one of the ones who's married there, that they're living in this very tumultuous time and they're facing a famine, which is God's punishment for their sin. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. There's a little irony in this text. There's a famine in the land. The irony is the word Bethlehem in Hebrew means house of bread. It means house of food. It means there's plenty of food. The word Bethlehem means plenty of food. And so here is a man and his wife living in a city named Plenty of Food in the middle of a famine. And what they find they have to do is not just leave Bethlehem, but they have to go to another country. Now, it sounds like a fairly big ordeal until you consider that it's probably only about 20 miles from Bethlehem to the mountains of Moab. Moab was actually the son of Abraham's nephew, Lot. So the Israelites and the Moabites were kin, distant cousins, but they had a very rough relationship. And for that reason, God didn't really like the fact that Elimelech goes over to live in the land of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and they lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons, and they married Moabite women, named Orpah, it's easy to say Oprah, and the other named Ruth. There's a lot going on in this text that you might not recognize at first. One thing to remember is that Hebrew names always mean something. Now, English names do too, but oftentimes the English name means I'm connected to this person, or we really like that person. They were a celebrity. We named our kid after a celebrity. But in Hebrew, the name was usually associated with something going on in your life at that time. So Elimelech is a Hebrew word that means my God is my king. So Elimelech evidently is trying to live faithful to the one true God. The name Naomi actually means happy. So what's the English translation of that? What would we think of? It's just a name like Joy. We would say Joy. Her name just means happy. She's a happy person, living with a guy whose name means God is my king. Their two sons' name means something along the lines of weak. And it may actually be nicknames given to them after they got sick and died. But whatever the case, we find this really odd situation where Happy, the woman, ends up in Moab, and her husband dies, And then we find out in the last part of our text that after they had lived there for about 10 years, both Machlon and Chilion also died, and Happy was left without her sons and without her husband. And so she becomes quite unhappy. That's actually not just a play on her name, but it appears a little bit later in the book where she says, quit calling me Naomi. Quit calling me Happy. I'm not happy anymore. So what's going on in our text? Well, the book of Ruth is setting us up for a really important principle that I want to sort of conclude the lesson with. And maybe a little bit longer conclusion, but we're kind of entering that application phase. The book of Ruth is going to show you how to be somebody's family. And before I get into that, can I just say, in a lot of ways, we have circles of family. You have your immediate family, whatever you want to count that as. Parents, in my case, parents, brothers and one sister, my children, my wife, maybe our in-laws if we want to stretch it out that far. But I count them as my family. That's who I think of when I think of family. But I want you to know that the Bible also teaches us that our church is our family. So for a minister, this is really instinctive. I hope it's instinctive for you. It should become instinctive that you start to think of your church as your spiritual family and that you actually begin to feel a certain sense of connection with your church that's very similar to what you can feel with your own family. I do feel that. I will say that, you know, when you're a minister, you're going to feel it probably a little bit more. When you're sick and your church responds like you have responded to me, then the bond really gets strong, so that it's really difficult in some ways for me even to sift out which is my natural family and which is my church family, because it's kind of all the same to me. And when I say church, in my case, I hope you can get here. I'm not trying to make you feel bad if you're not here. But in my case, it's North Boulevard. So the church universal is also my family. Sometimes I think of that, but usually it's North Boulevard that I think of. That you may not have been destined for me, but I was destined for you. I was destined to have North Boulevard. I see that in my life now. God designed me to be here, and He put me here. He put me here twice, and this is where I hope to die. Not exactly in the pulpit, but at some point down the road. Although if I keep smoking crack and preaching, it could, maybe it'll happen. Stop. So what I want you to see is that you have your immediate family, you have your church family, but let me just stretch you a little bit further. Let me remind you that every single person you meet needs a family. Like even your enemies, really, in Adam, are still your family. And what a better world it would be if we thought of our enemies that way. You remember when Paul, who was called Saul, was sent to meet Ananias? So he was a persecutor of Christians. He was as far from the Christian faith as you could get. And the Lord stops him on this road to Damascus, says, I got something for you. Go meet a guy in Damascus. He goes. Ananias goes and meets Paul. And what does he say? What's the first word he says to this persecutor of Christians? Brother. That's his first word. I mean, this would be the equivalent of Alexander Cortez, you know, going and speaking directly to, I don't know, Ted Cruz and saying, brother, let's talk this out. I mean, actually, the world would be a better world if we did that. It'd be a better world if we looked at everybody as our brother. Doesn't mean you have to agree. In fact, I hope you don't agree with a lot of things. But it does mean that you treat people with kindness and respect. That everybody you meet, there are two things you can say about everybody you meet. Everybody you meet is fighting a great cosmic battle, and they need some kindness. And the second thing I can say is everybody you meet needs a family. Everybody you meet needs a family. We all need family. And so the cool thing about following Jesus is that every one of us gets the chance to be somebody's family. And that's really what I want you to see today from the book of Ruth, is that Ruth is challenging you to go be somebody's family. Be a good family member with your birth family. Like, do your part to make it work. In your church, do your part to make it work. You can't control, none of us can control the direction that a church goes, North Boulevard. I mean, you might think that there's, like, behind the green curtain, there's some wizard, and the wizard, maybe the elders in this case, or one of the preachers, is sort of instigating everything and pulling all the levers. Oh, my goodness, it's not happening that way. It's just a huge, massive community of 3,000 people. And really, in the end, if we don't all bring ourselves to it and bring our best game to it, it's just not going to be the fullness of what God designed it to be. Each of us gets to bring family to it. Each of us gets to be somebody else's family. And that matters because it gives us an ethic for how to relate to people. That I get to take care of you even if you're 5,000 miles away. This is why you would adopt. Because you understand that even 5,000 miles away, you're still my family. You're still part of my family. So I want you to see three important terms that appear in Ruth. I'm going to show you the Hebrew. I'm not sure why I did that. Sometimes it just seems to me like the right thing to do until I get up here. But three different times, these are very important concepts in the book of Ruth. I mean, more than just common words. These are foundational theological principles upon which the book of Ruth is written. The first one is the word grace. And grace in this text means a little bit more than what it means to most of us. It means something along the lines of showing people love even when you don't necessarily like them. That's what grace is. Faithfulness, the Hebrew word chesed, appears three times, and it means something like we're now in a covenant with each other, and we're not going to give up. So faithfulness is refusing to give up. It's just me saying, I used to say this to the kids, maybe I should still say it, but I used to say to my kids when they were younger that I want you to know I will never leave you, ever, and I will never give up on you. I said that a lot of times. I would say it even from the pulpit because I wanted my kids, whatever else happened, to have the security of knowing they're always going to have a dad, unless death takes me, that I'm not going to walk away from them. That's what this word chesed or faithfulness actually means. And the third word that appears 22 times in Ruth, there's only four chapters. That means one out of every 100 words in the book of Ruth is this third word. It is the word redeemer. It's a technical word in Hebrew. Let me just sort of expound it quickly by saying a redeemer is a fixer in Hebrew. A redeemer is someone who says, okay, this is broken. This is messed up. You've done something or I did something, and we're not going to leave it this way. A redeemer is somebody who's willing to go the second mile, to pay the extra price in order to make the relationship right. This is the hardest one because it takes time. It involves a lot of pain. It can sometimes mean setting your pride aside. But redemption means our relationship is too important for it to remain broken. And I'm not going to let it remain broken. And that needs to be played out in your own family, your birth family. But it also needs to be played out in your church family. And to some extent, even in the world, which is our family in Adam. So I want to look at each of the three of these real quickly and just apply them. And here's what I want you to get out of the lesson. It's kind of like three simple words. When you walk out the door, be somebody's family. Just walk out the door, be somebody's family. Treat people like family. Treat even the foreigner like family. That's what makes the book of Ruth work so well. Ruth is a foreigner. She's a daughter-in-law who is a foreigner. I skipped right past the text in Deuteronomy where the Old Testament had said that no Moabite is allowed to go into the temple for 10 generations. That is, Ruth, she didn't even have access to the forgiveness of sins that were offered down at the temple because she was a Moabite. And yet you're going to see in the book how much of this grace, faithfulness, and redemption is offered to her and to her family. And if that's the message of Ruth, if that's why this little book is in here, because you have to ask, why this short story in the middle of this tumultuous period of the judges? Well, the answer is so that I can go out of this building today and be somebody's family. Yes. Go out and be somebody's family. And here's what it looks like. First of all, it does mean showing grace. As Paul says in Colossians 3:13, bear with one another. And I want to say showing grace in the Bible doesn't just mean forgiveness. But as Paul says in that text I just showed you, forgiveness is a second thing. Showing grace means that I'm not going to ask you to be sorry for the way you are. I'm just going to accept you the way you are. And this is actually a real strain in our relationships because, to be honest with you, most of us are hoping everyone will be like I want them to be. And the reality is they're not. This is true in marriage, for example. Daddy, I know you're watching. I hope I get this right. I'll tell you as your son how I perceived your marriage to Mama. So Mama passed away in 2002, and I love Mary Sue, Daddy's wife, my stepmother. I say that because they're both watching. Even if they weren't watching, I still love them. My dad is the perfect green on the color wheel, perfect green. Daddy only thinks in scientific, logical ways, and my mom was a perfect blue. I doubt Mama ever had a linear thought in her life. Everything was in patches of deep emotions and feelings. Now, which one's right? And the answer is neither is right. How well did that work? Well, I can tell you as their son, there were times it didn't work so well that they really had a hard time communicating, that Mama often felt unloved. Nobody loved Mama like Daddy, but she didn't feel it because that wasn't her language. The linear, you know, in Daddy's mind, I provide for you. That's how I show you I love you. And he really meant it. It's a huge act of love. Mama needed to feel love in a really emotional way, and Daddy didn't, he didn't deny it, he just didn't know how to do it. I'm not sure he ever figured it out, even today. Daddy, I'm not sure you ever figured it out. But here's what I got as their son, as difficult as that was for them. As their son, I got the emotional side of my mother. I got to see that. And I got the linear, logical side of my dad. So, like, I got the blessing of both of those growing up in that household. Here's what they had to learn to do. They had to learn how to show grace to each other. That's the only way families work, is if we learn, I cannot change the way you are. So I'm going to love you the way you are. That's grace in the book of Ruth. Ruth could not change the fact that she was a Moabite. But watch how Boaz loves her anyway. He loves her even though she was a widow. Had already been married. It's a bit of a problem in the ancient world. We can talk about that maybe as we get further in the series. Now, I want you to see that when you go and show somebody that you are their family, you got to show a lot of grace to people. They're not going to be everything you want them to be. But I got news for you. While you're worried about the fact that the person you're married to isn't everything you want them to be, the rest of us are secretly talking about how you're not everything we wanted you to be. That's kind of a joke. Feel free to laugh at that. But the truth is, look at what all God has to put up with me. So why should I be irritable that someone else is not what I want them to be? All right, the second term that you see in the book of Ruth played out several times is this word faithfulness, which is committing someone over the long haul, committing to someone over the long haul. And so in this text, the book of Ruth, faithfulness means we're in a covenant with each other. We're in it for life. So family is a long-term investment. It's really helpful to think of it that way. Church family is a long-term investment. When you come to church, look, if you have not been irritated by your church, it's only because you haven't been a Christian for very long. Just hang around. We'll irritate you soon. If you're not at times really, really angry with your church or angry with somebody in your church, it's only because you're not very involved. Because once you get really involved in the life of your church, you're going to be irritated and you're going to be angry. And you're actually probably going to be abused a little bit. And that's only because everyone else here is also human. So what we have to remind ourselves of is this. We're in this for the long haul. We made a commitment to one another. And by staying in it long haul, we work out our problems. We don't run away from our problems. I'm reminded of raising children here. I've told you already, I used to tell my kids, I will never leave you. But I can tell you that I don't know that I'm a natural father. There's some discussion of that in my family. That it's not natural. I'm the perfect hunter, you know. I just want to go accomplish something all the time. That's what I want to do. I want the next target. As soon as this target's hit, I want the next one. And I want the next one. I want the next one. And the idea of stopping and raising children was always tough for me. I mean, I love my children. I don't mean it in any way other than it's not in my personality. So to stop and spend time with my children was always difficult for me. And what I would always tell myself is, this is a long-term investment. It will pay back. One day, every hour I put in front of Nintendo with Jonathan will pay back in less money I have to pay an attorney to get him out of jail. That's really how I would reason. I can remember praying to God, because I didn't really care that much for Nintendo, to say the least. And I would say, Lord, may every hour I spend in front of Nintendo pile up as some blessing in heaven, you know, because this is not easy for me to sit here and do this. But I was just trying my best to communicate to my son, we're in this thing for the long haul. By the way, Jonathan's had 3 baptisms in the last week or so, so I think Nintendo was worth it. I'm feeling good about that. Think of family as a long-term investment and not as a one-off or as something, you know, hey, if I don't like it, I'm just going to walk out. American consumerism has really hurt us because I ask the question, why would my grandparents, Joseph Arthur Young, Ida Mae Young, why would they have stayed married and seem to have no marriage problems? Because I don't think they did. And the answer is because they didn't expect a whole lot. Like Ida Mae didn't think that Arthur, I said Joseph, Joseph's my other grandfather, Ida Mae didn't think that Arthur was going to make her happy. She was just happy that he was a good man. And that's what she would say, I got a good man for a husband. That was like enough for her. But today we bring enormous emotional expectations to our family that they cannot possibly fulfill. Like we come to our families and say, make me happy, or else. And nobody can fulfill that. So we need to bring a different set of expectations that are more commensurate with the commitment that we've made to one another. So as Paul says, we devote to one another in love. And then third, the last word, is that we need to be willing to redeem family. So in the short term, it means whether you've done wrong or whether the other one has done wrong, take whatever time you need to sort of get back on your feet. It may take a little while. We're okay with that. But then take your hat off and go make it right, even if you're not the one who did the wrong. I remind you what Jesus said in Matthew. Where are we? I didn't change the text. That says Matthew chapter 5. If you're offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, he doesn't say, and there remember that they hurt you. He says, if you're offering your gift at the altar and you remember that you hurt them or you gave them some reason to be irritable with you, go on and leave your gift right there and first go be reconciled to your brother, then come back and offer your gift. What Jesus is teaching us is that we need to be willing to make broken things right again. So for the last, I don't know how many years, 20 years or so, a number of churches have picked this Sunday out of the year, the second Sunday of November, as Orphan Sunday, a day we just sort of highlight the importance of adoption, taking care of children who don't have a family. This is, I think, the supreme form of redemption, because what we're doing is we're not just willing to, you know, buy back a difficult situation in our family, you know, settle a matter where we may have said the wrong thing to a parent or to a husband or a wife. But in adoption, foster care, what we're saying is, I'm willing to heal the brokenness in the world, even if it's 5,000 miles away. And this really is sort of an extreme witness of the mercies and the grace of God. I do want you to know that North Boulevard is, we actually have a ministry of adoption. We've got money set aside to help you should you decide, you know, our family's interested in this, because it's a very expensive process. And I think more of you are sort of waking up to this. I want to lay a challenge out there. The early church, first several centuries of Christianity, made adoption sort of a centerpiece of what they did. It wasn't easier then, but it was a lot easier to get children then, because children were often just abandoned. You saw them walking the streets. And so the early church just said, we can't walk by this. We can't let this. We're not okay with this. One of the greatest witnesses to the pagan Roman world that Jesus is who he says he is was the fact that the early church was willing to adopt children who were not their own. That actually wasn't a very common thing in the Roman world. And I will say that today it may cost more in some senses. It may be harder to get through all the bureaucratic hoops, probably most of which are good. But who has ever had the wealth that we have to do something like this? Who's ever had the ability that we have to do this? And so I want to put it on your heart to think about adoption and fostering as very important witnesses to the mercies of God, but also as a way of offering at least some redemption to a world that's broken. I just want to tell you a real quick story as we wrap it up. Every year, we have done a Christmas event for Cedar Grove. Cedar Grove is a, it offers services for boys between ages, what, maybe 10 or 11 up to high school. Boys who have been caught in a sexually abuser scenario situation. So the boys there are in trouble. They're all in trouble. By the way, we've interacted with them quite a bit, and I love the staff. I think the staff's great staff. They have their hands, their work cut out for them. Their hands are full there. You have to ask, what has happened in the lives of these boys that led them to do the things that they've done, that it would get them at Cedar Grove? Many of the boys don't have fathers. They don't have functional families. And they get there, and it's as much as the center tries to do the best, which I believe in. It's only 1 mile from here. It's a tough place to be for these kids. So we do a Christmas for them. And Sunette P. will ask your small group, if she hasn't already, who are you going to adopt this year for the Christmas this time? A couple of years ago, we got an email in the general church mailbox, and it came to me. And it was a mother whose son has been put at Cedar Grove. He was arrested, so I don't remember if she even says how old the boy was. Something in my head says he was 12 years old, but I may be wrong on that. But if you can imagine your 12-year-old son arrested because he sexually assaulted several girls. In fact, she says who it is in the letter which she sent. It was his own sister's. He's handcuffed. He's taken down to jail. And eventually he's sentenced to a period at Cedar Grove. If you just sort of put your head on that and think, oh my goodness, what this has done to the family. She said for several months that he's been there, he hasn't smiled once, not one single time has he smiled. The whole family's in trauma. Until the Christmas party that we had for the boys that year, a couple of years ago. And she sent the letter to all of us, so I don't mind reading the last few sentences to you. I just want to give you a sense of why it matters. She says, the whole family has struggled, but, and now I'm quoting, last night sitting there listening to the comedy, because we had comedy that year, watching my stepson laugh and smile for the first time in months, and listening to the powerful message delivered brought tears to my eyes. From day one, we've told our son that we may not know why or how or what God is doing, but we know he has a plan through all of this, and even though it seems horrible, our son is right where he belongs. We've prayed many prayers similar to this throughout it all, but it sure was wonderful to hear the same message delivered last night to our son and all the other boys. My heart aches for all the boys who don't have that family support, and I just want to say thank you to North Boulevard for what you've done. Seeing your church love our boy as family and all the other boys who may just need a little bit more was amazing. Thank you for being his family. So the book of Ruth is all about this. It's about learning how to be family. How to be family for the people in our home underneath our roof. How to be family for our brothers and sisters in your small group and then in the church at large. And learning this huge skill of how to be family to the world. We're going to walk through the book of Ruth. But if you want to know one thing, one simple thing from the book of Ruth that you can take home with you today, here it is. Go be somebody's family. Go be family. Let's stand up and sing.